Rutgers, explaining just how robust this is, along with a few loopholes. And even by itself, just pushing the Gluino up, starting to probe naturalness directly, regardless of what you do to the stops and the rest of your spectrum. And that's due to the two-loop running of the Higgs soft masses. So with your Gluino up above a TEV, you're starting to probe fine-tuning at the 1 to 10% level at least. Of course, this can get much, much worse depending on the details of your theory. So for the purposes of this talk, I want to take these results as a guide in the sense that we'll take the theory to be the standard model all the way up and the weak scale to just be simply fine-tuned. And in order to try to explain how that fine-tuning comes about, we want to try to use environmental selection to get the weak scale from sort of random cancellation between parameters. So let me explain how this game works for those of you who are not used to thinking about anthropics. The idea is motivated from string theory, where you have a vast landscape of vacua, and we take the physical parameters to be different in each of these vacua, and finally scanned enough that we can approximate that as a continuum. Then you have kind of a model, a mapping from your parameter space into the landscape. And eternal inflation or something like that gives you a way to populate these various vacua so you could actually realize any one of these different universes. And then you can ask, among the set of vacua, is our vacuum typical? And the anthropic principle says that we should ask a slightly different question. We should make that a conditional probability, which is that among the set of vacua that contain observers, is our vacuum typical? So the rules of the game, as I'm going to play it, are a model of an anthropic explanation. It consists of a set of parameters that are going to be scanning throughout these different vacua, a set of the parameter space, a region of parameter space that is friendly to observers, or at least a region of parameter space that is inhospitable, so that we know what the set of vacua we should base this conditional probability on is. And then you have to have a set of prior distributions. You have to know what the a priori likelihood of your various parameters are. Once you've got all these things set in place, you can ask, is our vacuum likely among those that contain observers? Now, that's almost a well-posed question. When you have all these ingredients, there's still the measure problem. I'm going to skirt that simply by trying to argue that the weak scale is bounded to be pretty close to the weak scale in every vacuum that contains observers. So I won't get into the details of, is our vacuum, you know, 70% likely or 10% likely? This will depend on the rest of these things. Yes. So I'll try to be as general as possible in assuming what is what it means to be hospitable to an observer. So a good example of this kind of thinking, one of the oldest argument that I'm aware of is from Weinberg back in 1987, and he argued that the cosmological constant might be selected environmentally in the sense that perhaps the various ingredients that cancel to give you a light cosmological constant, these are all generally quite large, and occasionally this gives you small cancellations, but every vacuum containing observers will have a small cosmological constant. And the argument is that if the energy density from the cosmological constant is large compared to the virial energy density of a collapsing halo, then the system will be gravitationally bound against the Hubble flow. And so you won't have any structure formation. So the fundamental assumption there is that observers need galaxies, or at least need stuff that's not just evenly distributed around the universe.
But how sensitive is that to the assumption that the primordial fluctuations
of one part of the universe? Good. So that'll be the theme of this talk. It'll be how robust is this to changing that anthropic model. So here, this is there was a nice field theory example, a toy model of the landscape given by Nima and others back in 05, where he had scanning cosmological constant. And what they do is they take only the dimensionful parameters to scan. So their model is that lambda and v, or at least the components of lambda and v, are scanning. And the prior distribution, because you are taking these fine-tunings to arise from cancellations, the prior distribution is just quadratic in the VEV and quartic in the cosmological constant. And with that, they use these observer boundaries. So as I mentioned, we have the Weinberg argument from structure, and as I'll go into a little more detail about in a moment, you have the atomic principle that bounds the VEV, and then you can ask, in this particular model, is our universe likely among vacuum observers? Since most not all of the vacua are concentrated in this upper right-hand corner. The fact that our universe sits right near the corner means that this is a quote-unquote successful anthropic model. Now, as you mentioned, if I start changing my my model, if I change the assumptions, then this can break down. So the good example is for Weinberg. Even leaving delta rho over rho fixed, I said I have to compare the energy density from the cosmological constant to the virial density, which is proportional to the matter density. So if I increase the amount of dark matter, then I could increase the cosmological constant, at least in principle, without bound. So if we have time, I'll talk a little bit more about that at the end. I want to focus on the electroweak VEV and do exactly the same thing to this atomic principle boundary. So what that is, this is what happens as you start to vary the weak scale. If I have my quark masses are proportional to it, and I fix the Yukawas here, taking them to not be dimensionful and therefore not be scanning, then as I raise the VEV, the pion starts to get heavier, and so the internucleon forces get weaker, and eventually these things fission. And that was this green region, and we're actually quite close by. As a matter of fact, if you go the other direction, you also have a problem. As I decrease the electroweak VEV, the neutron-proton mass difference gets small faster than the electron mass does. So eventually, hydrogen becomes unstable to the proton absorbing the electron and becoming a neutron. And we're also sort of strangely close by to here. This was studied by Donahue and a number of collaborators in a couple of papers. I'm going to use this complex nuclei boundary for the rest of the talk, but it actually won't quite be this one. You can do a little bit better than this by requiring that the neutrons inside of the nucleus not decay. And so there what you have is, rather than the binding energy be greater than zero, it needs to be greater than the binding energy per nucleon has to be greater than the energy released by a neutron decay. Okay, so that'll be slightly stronger, but a very similar boundary. So as you may have noticed, that actually depended on the quark masses. So in a more general landscape where I do allow the Yukawas to vary, let's say, for example, they really come from dimensionful parameters if you're trying to do Nieman's toy model, so say a Froggatt-Nielsen model, some number of VEVs, or if the model is just different, then this is the situation. I've got here on the x-axis the up-type quark masses, on the y-axis the down-type quark masses, and here are the three generations, the standard model, and this is the three dots are just to give you an idea of if the Yukawas are varying, what is the scale over which they should vary. Well, we know these are the realized values. The boundaries you see here only act on the first generation, of course, so you should not read anything into the fact that they're on the same plot as the dots. This is the first generation quark masses, and from the point of view of varying the VEV, that would be shifting these red dots along the diagonal. You would expect, if this anthropic model describes our universe, that we are close to this green boundary. From the point of view of that landscape, it's a total accident that we're also this close to the hydrogen stability boundary. And just zooming in on this little bit here, you can see how close we are. The uncertainties here, this blue uncertainty comes from the lattice, which there's a nice talk by Andre Walker-Lude, does a lattice average of various considerations of the isospin violating contribution to the neutron-proton mass difference. So that's what we use there. And then the green uncertainty comes from Donahue. Actually, the green line is oxygen, but Donahue argues that the binding energy per nucleon is going to be independent of A for large A. So, for example, the line for lead is almost right on top of that. We'll take that to be the line for all complex nuclei. And this actually, the story of being nearby this boundary is also true if I start to vary the electron mass. If I let the electron mass drop, it can go all the way down to zero. You never get very far away. And in fact, as I raise it, I wipe out our universe after it gets bigger than a factor of 2 or so. And by a factor of, say, 15, there's no allowed space left at all, no matter how far back you go in the up-type mass.
Wait, so how is there any hydrogen stability region in the limit where
N equals 0? What I meant by hydrogen stability is Mn minus Mp is bigger than Me. So that's, Me goes to zero maybe is not a well-defined limit, but you can take this for, this is how far away you could even conceivably get. So again, for our universe, we're sort of anomalously close to this extra boundary in the full 3D Yukawa space for the light generation. So we want to take that as motivation that maybe in the landscape the Yukawas also scan, and then ask, is this model of the weak scale being environmentally selected robust to changing this assumption? And the answer, of course, is no. The nuclear physics boundaries, they depend on the quark masses, and as soon as I allow the Yukawas to scan, then I've got this degenerate direction where I can increase the VEV and decrease the Yukawas. If the prior distribution really strongly preferred a large M Planck scale VEV, then why don't we live in a universe where the quark masses are what they are, but the VEV is Planck scale? And of course, that's the weakless universe that was described by Ronnie Harnick and company, where they argue that actually we could even live in such a world. It wouldn't be that different from our own. So the point of this project is to explore why this didn't happen. Is there any other reason that Anthropics might select the VEV? So in order to do that, we don't want to look at nuclear physics per se. We need to find the ways that weak physics actually affects our low energy world. And the three things that life here seems to depend on, we have BBN, depends on the weak scale. There's the PP chain in stars, but in addition to this depending on the weak scale, as I change V, I'll change this rate. It's also highly temperature dependent. So I suspect that possibly if you were to change the weak scale, the stars could re-equilibrate at a slightly different temperature, and this wouldn't give you any anthropic bound. There's also type 2 supernovae, which have sort of a neutrino shockwave. The simulations, as far as I'm aware, are not yet mature enough to really answer the question of how important the neutrino shockwave is for dispersing heavy elements around the universe with these supernovae. And aside from that, you also have type 1. So we decided to look at BBN, which has the advantage of being very simple, sort of. Luckily for us, we don't need the full reaction network. Everything that I'm going to talk about starts with the primordial proton neutron abundance and goes to helium-4. So in terms of course, we simulated the whole thing, but in terms of our understanding, we can get away with just looking at this very small part. So what are the ways that BBN depends on the weak scale? Well, the dominant thing that's going to be important is that the neutron-proton interconversion rate, the freeze out of this process, determines the initial neutron abundance. And because this cross-section goes like G Fermi squared, the freeze-out temperature goes like the VEV to the 4/3. And the initial neutron-to-proton abundance is given by the exponential of the mass difference over the freeze-out temperature. And it's a total accident in our universe that this comes out to be the same size as this. So that explains why the helium abundance is comparable to the hydrogen abundance in our universe. You don't get BBN in terms of your intuition. You won't get BBN very wrong if you just assume that for every neutron you start with that survives the deuterium bottleneck, it takes a proton with it and binds it into helium-4. So this is a sixth, naively. That goes to a seventh when you include the neutron decays, and that gives you this quarter. So you can see that we have this not only this coincidence, but also an exponential dependence on the VEV. So that's going to be important. There are a couple of other more minor ways that BBN depends on the weak scale that we've included. Of course, the neutron-proton mass difference itself depends on the VEV through this isospin-violating contribution. And again, we use the lattice to fix that coefficient. And then the measurement of neutron-proton mass difference fixes the other coefficient. The neutron lifetime is a function of the VEV. It goes like V to the fourth, and that delta M is sort of the phase space factor, Mn minus Mp minus Me to the fifth. And lastly, you've got the deuterium binding energy and the production cross-section. We take these from this paper by this pack of Germans who did a very high-order chiral perturbation theory study with values pegged to lattice to find that their functional dependence on the pion mass. That'll be a minor effect, so the uncertainties from that are not really going to change the story. So this is the net result. As promised, not only do we live at this order one amount of helium, but we're on a very steep curve. We have this, you see this exponential dependence on the size of the VEV, and by the time you increase the VEV by a factor of 5 or 10, the universe is entirely made of helium. There's no hydrogen left, almost. There's this curve actually asymptotes at around 98% on 100%, and that's because by the end of BBN, the neutrons and protons are dilute enough that they don't find one another, so this process of deuterium creation freezes out. But at least up to that small difference, you very quickly run into an entirely helium-based universe. So of course, the question from the point of view of Anthropics is, can observers live in that universe? And how much helium can they tolerate? We didn't actually try to quantify this. And that's because there's a whole bunch of reasons that a helium universe might be problematic for observers. Everything in our world seems to depend quite heavily on hydrogen. So trying to figure out what the sort of proximate cause of killing your observers is a big job. So we leave that to future work, and we're just going to study the amount of helium that you get in BBN as a function of all these parameters, the Yukawas and the VEV. Various things that you might need hydrogen for. For example, it's important in halo cooling, the very earliest structures, the so-called POP3 stars that are supposed to distribute the heavy elements around the early universe, these things, the virial temperatures are too light for the collisional excitation of hydrogen. So in order to cool these structures and collapse to form the stars, you need hydrogen molecules, you need H2. Helium-4 doesn't form these molecules, so you don't get the molecular cooling. So that could be a potential problem. Of course, stars are powered by the PP chain. If you didn't have hydrogen around, you could still have stars. They would be helium-burning stars. But helium-burning stars only live for about 100 million years as compared to 1 to 10 billion years for hydrogen-burning stars. Yeah, so you can ask exactly how much hydrogen do you need, and that's something that we've not studied. I'm gonna fix the 90% contours in the plots I'll show later. So I don't know exactly how much you need for this. So you're right, you will do some cooling of your POP3 stars from the 2% hydrogen. You're gonna certainly slow down the cooling, and so there'll be, at the very least, there would be a cost, because the longer you wait, the closer you are to CC domination. So you would have to make the CC comparably smaller in order to have the same universe we do, at least. And of course, there's chemistry, depends on hydrogen. So depending on what set of these things observers actually need, that'll tell you what the real shape of this boundary should be in this multidimensional space. But I'm just gonna fix, as I said, to 90% helium. And this is what it looks like. So in the Y up, Y down VEV space, let me try to explain this plot, because there's a lot going on. Once again, this is the up quark mass on the x-axis, the down quark mass on the y, and you have the boundaries we discussed earlier. As I decrease m down minus m up, I decrease the neutron-proton mass difference enough to make hydrogen unstable. As I increase the pion mass, I run out of complex nuclei. And the dominant error here, by the way, comes from extrapolating the binding energy away from our value of the pion mass. That's why the error band shrinks as you approach our value of the pion mass over here. This gray region that says diproton bound, that's not a boundary. That's just a region where PP, the diproton, is a bound state. And I didn't include it in the reaction network. So rather than show you what the curves would have looked like without it, I've just grayed it out. But the effect of that should be somewhere between producing excess helium and nothing at all. You get excess helium if you think that two things happen from the bound states. Dineutron is also bound, so this gives you an extra population of stable neutrons. And also the diproton can decay to deuterium directly, or can scatter off electrons to make deuterium. Sorry, ask that again. I hadn't quite finished. These blue contours are the VEV compared to ours, and they're the contours of the VEV that give you 90% helium at each point in this space. Just to wrap up the diproton thing, possibly it'll give you more helium than you would get without having included it, but there are arguments in literature that actually they do nothing at all because the rates for all the reactions involving the diproton are too slow compared to the rest of BBN. So as I simply didn't include it. So you can see here that on this contour, this 5 contour, this is our universe, this red dot. If you raise our VEV by a factor of 5, then 90% of the universe is helium. And you maybe just can see that the contour starts to fold over as you go this way. And that effect is the increasing pion mass having an effect on the binding energy of deuterium and the cross section. Going the other direction, the neutron is becoming less and less stable, so it's decaying very rapidly. So even though you start with an order one, you start with 50% neutrons in the beginning, long before you can make deuterium that's stable against photodissociation, the neutrons will decay. And in order to compensate for that, you would have to raise the VEV to get the same amount of helium.
prevent the neutral from decaying?
Yeah, so this is all done at fixed electron mass. This is our electron mass. I am still in the process of making the various versions of this with larger values of electron mass, and it's exactly as you say. You might worry that as you go this way, you can continue. So going to larger electron mass allows me to move farther up like this, as we saw earlier. You might worry that allows you to continue increasing the VEV, but because the hydrogen stability boundary moves up this way as well, the neutrons don't live longer, so you don't continue to have this phenomenon. So everything peters out around 15. That's the, so for the entire allowed space of up, down, and electron masses, in our universe, the VEV cannot be larger than a factor of 15 or 20 than it is without the universe being dominated entirely by helium.
You're not changing
15 times the VEV?
No, sorry, but I mean, you're not assuming that we're living in a universe where the VEV is a Planck scale.
So I'm saying that, no, so this is saying that these are contours of the VEV compared to ours. Anybody else? This is the sort of major result. So let's.
I don't know what you're planning to do the last one. So, the same. We are in the red dot.
Yes.
And if our VEV were 5 times larger, then we'd be 90% helium.
Yes.
Okay. Now, if I move up, I raise the down part mass and lower the up part mass.
Yeah, in that case, that even though, so that, remember, the dominant effect of raising the VEV is to increase the freeze-out temperature of neutron-proton interconversion. So even though half of the original protons are now neutrons in the early universe, or sorry, as many as you have protons, you have neutrons in the early universe, those neutrons will decay at before the deuterium bottleneck is finished. And so you won't make helium, even though you started with enough neutrons to have lots of helium. The way that you avoid that, the way that you produce helium anyway, is to increase the VEV enough that the neutron becomes long enough lived to take protons with it into helium-4. So as you go in this direction, you can look at this as sort of contours of almost constant neutron lifetime. So increasing the VEV by a factor of 15 compared to our universe is what gives you the same amount of helium as increasing the VEV by a factor of 5 right here. You need to increase the VEV more out here than you do here in order to make 90% helium.
Right, but so I guess my next conclusion is that I can think of several ways of avoiding the conclusion and be left with a universe where I'm not 90% and still I'm allowed to keep going up.
Okay.
So,
I'll discuss a couple of them, but maybe if
well,
I don't hit them.
The
so the electron does not do that. Unfortunately, because this is still work in progress, I don't have the plots to show you. But as you increase the electron mass, the neutron is becoming long-lived.
I can reduce that electron mass, right?
You don't have very far to go. The electron mass is already slightly subdominant to the rest of to Mn minus Mp, right? Very quickly. I mean, so you can reduce this by a factor of maybe 50% at a given value of the VEV, but very quickly, as you lower the electron mass, that stops changing. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't realize which direction you're thinking. There are a couple of ways out of this, though. So for the model that I discussed, which was varying these quark masses and presumably the electron mass once I finished doing it, and the VEV, BBN does bound you in the entire allowed space. If you start to vary other parameters as you continue to tweak the model and ask how robust this bound is, you can presumably find other ways out. I'll discuss that now, if everybody's ready to move on. Okay.
You're saying that you're reaching a limit where the neutron mass, the neutron lifetime is completely dominated by just the proton, the neutron mass minus the proton mass, the fixed power, the bright metallic to the force power.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter what you lose to the electron, the lifetime will be so long that you cannot depopulate the PD.
Had I had this for fixed other parameters and just changing the electron mass, there's some value beyond which hydrogen is unstable, and then you can increase the amount of helium you get by increasing the electron mass away from our universe, And this will drop a bit if you lower the electron mass, but then this quickly asymptotes. Okay. So just as I said, this set of boundaries is enough to restore the landscape that I mentioned from NEMA before, and to environmentally select the weak scale, as long as those are the set of scanning parameters. But BBN does depend on other stuff besides what I just mentioned. And if I also allow those to scan, then the story does change. So this is more robust than we started with, but it's not all the way there yet. For example, if I were to vary the baryon antibaryon asymmetry, then as you increase it, nothing happens, effectively. As I decrease it, however, I don't have enough neutrons and protons around for them to make deuterium. So this reaction is going to freeze out. And you can see this is going to give you a potential runaway to large V. And you know, the exact value you need depends on how much helium you require. This is another pathway to get to the weakless universe. So this is a potential issue.
But you get the iron filing universe where things go to iron before you make stars.
Huh. So that didn't happen when I ran the code, but I will definitely look into that. Maybe you can.
I'm remembering a paper by Aguirre, I think it was.
Who?
Aguirre?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Some time ago, I guess, like 10 years ago, or so. When the anthropic things were kind of. Pressure and I remember him. I remember it stuck in my mind that he talked about the iron filing in the universe.
Thank you. That's interesting. I will look into that. I'm going to argue in a little bit that that's not allowed. So I've only considered here the nuclear boundaries in BBN. It's only fair if you're going to have me start to include more parameters that you let me start to introduce more boundaries. So if you do that, then actually I think you can stop Ada from running off this way. As I'll discuss later. So it's not going to be able to get very much larger than it is. And basically, that's the baryon fraction of the universe can't get bigger than order one. And that's because of silk damping. So I do want to check that out, but I don't think that's going to change this story too much. And anyway, the model that I've described where this is successful requires Ada to not scan. So if Ada scans, then we have this other large problem as well. You can do the same thing with M Planck. I mentioned the freeze-out dependence earlier. Freeze-out temperature has dependence on M Planck because of Hubble. And so as I increase the VEV, I can increase M Planck somewhat less and have a constant freeze-out temperature. So that's a potential runaway direction. And then you have the same thing happens as I lower M Planck. I'm increasing Hubble, and so you freeze out this process. So you have these runaway directions as well. So that's the, how are we doing on time here? That's the story for BBN. If the parameters were just the Yukawas and the weak scale, then the model is going to work. It'll be a sort of a successful anthropic model. But if you allow these other cosmological parameters to vary, then you're going to have these runaway directions. So I just want to briefly tell you what I've been thinking about a little bit about that. So if I start thinking about varying these cosmological parameters, say M Planck, the baryon, and the dark matter densities, then you have quite a number of anthropic boundaries that you can apply from structure formation. And just as a side note, even though I argued against doing this earlier, if I did have WIMP dark matter, by which I mean the cross-section is really due to weak physics, then the dark matter density is going to go like V squared. So if I were able to bound the dark matter density, then I would also bound the VEV. But even if you don't make that assumption, I think this is a relatively interesting thing to consider, because if you can bound the dark matter density, then you restore the original Weinberg solution to the CC problem. So you can't, if I can't increase rho virial, then that means I can't increase the cosmological constant without bound. Okay, and many of these boundaries were also considered by these people I've been mentioned. So let me introduce the three boundaries I'm going to talk about. The first is cooling. I mentioned before that hydrogen is important for this. You can see it's a very complicated story. There's line cooling here from hydrogen and helium. This is due to sort of collisional excitation of the energy levels. And that's for low, relatively low varial temperatures. Our galaxy, for reference, is right about here near the helium peak. And as I go to larger larger halos, so the varial temperature scales with the halo mass. So as I go to larger halos, then I have a big ionization fraction that develops. And so Bremsstrahlung becomes my dominant cooling mechanism. So the time scale for Bremsstrahlung cooling, this is just the energy in the halo divided by the cooling rate. And so this this is going to get longer as my halo gets bigger. So you see that actually I'm bounded from either side on the size of my halo by how efficiently I can cool it. So on the left end, for small halos, as I get below this collisional excitation of hydrogen, it takes me a very long time to cool because I need to use molecular hydrogen, which if I had included it, would be down here several orders of magnitude below the peak. And on the large halo end, the time scale for Bremsstrahlung is getting longer, but other relevant time scales like Hubble are not. So things like halo mergers will reheat the halo on time scales shorter than you can cool them down. So this is just to give you a sort of a bracket of halo masses that I want to consider when I'm using the other boundaries, because the other boundaries will also depend on the halo mass. This at least gives me a range to look at. So the other two boundaries I want to consider, the first is disk fragmentation. This is nothing but a Jeans instability. After you collapse the halo and the baryons continue to cool down into a disk, you need the disk to fragment into stars and stuff, we think, we assume. So this is the parametric form from these guys for the Jeans instability in a rotating disk system. And this just bounds your baryon fraction. If you don't have enough baryons, you can't fragment the disk. For the T-min, this is the temperature to which that disk will cool. I've just taken that to be 10 to the 4 Kelvin, which is that hydrogen line cooling endpoint. And it'll depend on the varial temperature. Finally, there's close encounters. This got mentioned at the colloquium briefly. In principle, we want to require that planetary orbits are stable against perturbations. And the perturbations can come from other nearby gravitational interactions. So the one that got mentioned at the colloquium was that we have an Oort cloud, and it sends periodically comets at the inner planets. And this is a very complicated story, because you've got Jupiter and Saturn sweeping the comets away. So rather than deal with all of that, we wanted to take a more conservative and much simpler viewpoint, which is that I don't want other stars to get closer to my planets than the parent star is. That, we think, would be bad for planetary orbits. So there's a rate at which that should happen. Given by some cross-section times the density of stars, and that should be longer than something. I don't know what the something is. I don't think anyone does, but a billion years seems to be relevant for us, so that's what I've used in the plots that I'll show you in a minute. And then I've just taken the density of stars to be proportional to the density of the disk. It's a huge simplification, and that could alter the results here. And for the cross-section, I've taken it to be an AU, and what I mean by an AU is the Goldilocks zone. So I want the luminosity of the star and the distance of the planet from the star to be such that the temperatures on the planet are relevant for chemistry. Chemistry is given by sort of the electron mass and the electromagnetic constant. And so this, I'm able to recast this rate into the cosmological parameters that we care about. So as the baryon fraction gets big, I get more and more stars, and they're going to collide with one another too often. Same thing with as the halo gets big. And as I turn off gravity, then that doesn't happen so much. OK, so I'm wrapping up. Promise I won't continue introducing boundaries. Here I've got eta on the y-axis. This is just rho baryon and rho dark on the x. And it's just as promised. You increase the baryon fraction, and stars hit one another. You decrease it, you can't fragment the disk. And this is bounded in rho dark matter, because as I increase rho dark at fixed eta, I'm lowering the baryon fraction. So that's why you can't fragment the disk. And then close encounters, remember, also depended just on the density of stuff that you had total. And so I've just shown you these for two different halo masses. These were the bookends from cooling. You could worry, of course, that in the direction where rho dark is getting larger as I increase the halo, that this depends, that cooling might depend on these parameters. And so I should be more careful. But if you look, this, in addition to being at larger rho dark, this is happening at smaller f baryon. So the cooling rate is actually going down. Question?
Shouldn't your goal be able to go to a further out of the galaxy where it doesn't be cold? So even if you increase your baryon function, diffraction, so you increase the density, so maybe where we are in the galaxy it's too dense, but then you go out a little bit and density falls.
Yeah, so I took, I guess in an isothermal profile, most of the galaxy is in this sort of flat region. But you're right, maybe there is something on the tail, the very outskirt. I haven't considered that. Yeah, that seems plausible. Of course, anything where I increase, I mean, that's a very steep slope, so that would be a sort of a fine-tuned solution, but.
Well, but you don't need more than one observer
Yeah, that's fair. Oh, it's absurd. No, yeah. that's a fair point. This is all actually not in the paper. These are just some things I've been thinking about. So that's fair. So you can do the same thing with M Planck. It's exactly the same story. The only difference is that now, where you're going to larger rho dark, M Planck is getting bigger, so gravity is getting weaker, and the cooling, and that means that the Hubble time is getting longer. So now actually the cooling time scale might be fast enough at larger and larger values of m, where this is allowed, so you need to be slightly more careful. And so I just included the cooling. And basically, you win because as you increase the halo mass, disk fragmentation is coming in faster than you're opening up new space, so this gets cut off. So with the exception of this potential objection about living on the outskirts of the galaxy, I think the various structure boundaries may actually keep you from increasing rho dark matter without bound, and at least then restore the Weinberg solution of the CC problem. If not, with WIMP dark matter, restore the anthropic selection of the VEV. But in any case, those parameters may not scan. If they don't scan, given the model where it's the Yukawas and the VEV, BBN and the atomic principle are enough to anthropically select a weak scale. And there's, as I said, there's some things I've left off. You can worry about Itai's suggestion. You can also worry about delta rho over rho, as brought up before. I mentioned silk damping. There's tons of stuff once you get into the structure formation game. So this is very much an open question. ME, I'm almost done with, actually. But anyway, that's all I had. So thank you very much.
What's the silk damping issue? I mean, what's the...
Yeah, so the idea is that, so in our universe, you have these perturbations from dark matter that are growing, and baryons will, even if you had no perturbation of the baryons, they fall in after recombination. If this is dominated by baryons, then the free streaming from the photons before recombination will drag baryons along with it, and it'll flatten this stuff out. And if you don't have a large dark matter component, then you don't have big metric perturbations to fall back into. And so you really pretty badly obliterate structure. It's not a hard boundary, because you can wait long enough and you'll still grow. But it's definitely something to consider when you're jacking up eta and fixing the other parameters.
Is there some growing understanding of what scans and what doesn't? Are there any kind of developments?
I would say that the realization that we're at the point of a cone in this larger Yukawa space in terms of boundaries, I think that's reasonable evidence that if this procedure makes sense at all, that the Yukawas are also scanning, and that wasn't realized before we did this. So yeah, growing. It's a hard game.
How I'm turning it into a bed or something.
Yeah, so I think the dimensionful argument is bad. I don't buy that argument. But I also think it's perfectly plausible that not everything scans in the landscape. So I think, you know, I think we need to slowly increase the number of things that we consider, and as our understanding of astrophysics and nuclear physics gets stronger, then we can make studies like this and start to understand under what assumptions the anthropic principle robustly gives us the weak scale.
And
And when you were scanning the weak scale, you're keeping Planck scale constant, right?
Yes. So when I was scanning, so I have three scales. I have, you know, the weak scale, I have the Planck scale, and I've got the QCD scale. So one of those is just fixed by whatever I'm calling a JEV. So in the earlier thing, you can take the JEV to be fixed by the ratio of lambda QCD to the M Planck, and I'm fixing that while I vary the weak scale. And then later on, I fix the weak scale and vary the Planck to lambda QCD ratio. But I haven't done those in any, you know, concurrent way. I haven't tried to do the giant parameter space scan, including M Planck.
As I was thinking about your, I'm forgetting now, because for the Goldilocks, right, like if you change something, you can also just change the gravitational constant, and then your orbits will be bigger.
Yes, sir. But with bigger orbits, gives you bigger opportunity to get smacked by another star.
And you get smaller orbits.
Yeah, so those are the patterns that were shown.
Okay, so
that was happening.
Any other questions? Not then, that's the thing.